I went to Stamford Hill driving, and I'm sure you've done the same.
My friends say the same thing.
No, going to the hospital, and there's a Jewish section.
Yes, the Royal Free.
Wait, hold on.
The whole top upstairs.
Now listen to this. The men, this is a street in London, yeah, in liberal London. The men are walking on one side of the road, and the women are. Now I'm saying, hold on. Okay, you've done what you needed to do. No problem. Yeah, I haven't got a problem with that. Okay, but we're not talking about inside the synagogue. We're talking about in the streets. Everything that Islamophobic people are angry about Islam with is found in Judaism. Done, done, done. Everything from A to Z.
Bismillah, alhamdulillah, assalamu alaikum, greetings of peace. Welcome to the Deen Show, which is a way of life we try to put out there for everyone to see, helping you understand Islam and Muslims. Have you guys met Muhammad? Hijab, well, he's here with me on the Deen Show. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
How you doing, my brother?
Doing? You're right. I'm good.
Alhamdulillah.
Alhamdulillah.
We had a nice training, huh?
Yeah, we did.
Alhamdulillah.
Especially with your, mashallah, advanced black belt skills. I mean, you definitely know how to take it out of someone.
Mashallah. Alhamdulillah. I know we worked up a nice sweat, and I can't leave my brother without some, you know, some proteins and some.
Some proteins, yeah.
Yeah, some nice. Juice over here.
Oh, okay.
Okay, to replenish the body. Now,
mashallah, what's in this juice?
Okay, so I'm gonna have you taste it. You're gonna have to trust me.
Okay.
All right. So, I'm gonna get you some here and tell me you got some protein in here. You got some natural sugars. All right, because we burned off a lot from the training.
Bismillah.
You know, we've been talking a lot about also nutrition on the Deen Show. I don't know. People have been following along. It's real important. How's it taste?
Tastes actually quite good.
Bismillah. Good one, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I could have gave you...
What's in it? What's in
I could have gave you a... Yeah. One of those protein shakes. But if you look at the back of most of these, you have a list of ingredients that you need a chemistry degree to pronounce. So here, three
okay.
ingredients.
Okay.
You got one banana, okay. right, for the sugar, mm-hmm. natural sugar, yeah. and then you had two raw eggs. It got to be raw.
Eggs in this, yeah.
You want protein? Yeah. We go straight to the source, huh?
Wow, man, it doesn't taste like it's got eggs in
this. But it has to be organic. It has to be from, you know, healthy chickens. And then you got some cashew milk. Bam, got it, done. Three ingredients. Now compare that next time when you have, you know, what was that? What was that that one that you had before? What was it called? Mother's milk? What was it called? Muscle milk. You heard of this muscle milk?
No.
Turn that around, and you've got like 20 different ingredients and what in this, and you don't got only Allah knows what's, you know, in there. This stuff can really, a lot of it can have a negative effect on the body.
Yeah.
So you like that?
That was good, mashallah.
All right, good.
It doesn't taste like it had any eggs in it whatsoever.
No.
Yeah.
Many people are scared of the...
Yeah, because like it's raw eggs.
Yeah.
Was it raw? It's obviously raw eggs.
Raw.
So yeah, so it's got to be...
That's it.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we got some... We have some jiu-jitsu going. Yeah. We got some nutrition here.
Well, you're not the only one. I mean, I'm not the only fan of your jiu-jitsu.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I'm not the only fan of your jiu-jitsu because, I mean, we've got someone who is actually of note who is wearing your T-shirt. I mean, let's take a look at this.
Oh! Hey, that's our buddy. We were actually our friend Joe Rogan.
That's your T-shirt, though, isn't it?
Yeah, that is our T-shirt. Yeah,
that's your surname on that.
That's my surname, and that's my last name.
So, because you made a video right with one of the mashayikh before about Joe Rogan and some of his some of the things that he said about Islam.
Yeah,
what do you think? This is a kind of peace offering, or what is this?
I don't know. I think. You know, like I mentioned in the video we did, we really wanted to reach out to Joe in a benign and nice, kind way.
Mm-hmm.
And because we're a small community, the community of jiu-jitsu practitioners, and he's done a lot of good in bringing jiu-jitsu to the forefront, right? You got to give acknowledgement where acknowledgement is due. Mm-hmm. And he talks about other good topics here about nutrition and other things.
Mm-hmm. This is what you got in the recipe.
No, I'm actually, if Joe turns in, maybe I could turn him out to this recipe, right? I got this actually for my nutritionist, Jim Marlowe.
All right, okay.
Yeah. So now Joe, he kind of went out of his lane. He started to talk about something that's near and dear to over 1.7 billion human beings on the planet, Muslims, right?
Yeah.
And Muslims, as you know, and I know as someone who simply is taking that free choice that he has, that I have, a woman has, a man has, and just submitted their will to the will of the Creator. That's it. So he started talking about Islam. He started bringing on guests. Mm-hmm. And we academically, without much emotion, right, not just, you know, hurling any insults or whatnot, we went, and me and the imam from his area, we went one by one. He talked about FGM, female genital mutilation. We
acid attacks.
Yeah. You have a lot of those now against Muslims, right? In
I mean, this is interesting. I found it really interesting that he was making the point that acid was thrown by Muslims on Muslims or by Muslims on non-Muslims. Where I'm from, obviously in London, particularly in East London, in parts of London, that's actually happening now to Muslims. Acid has always been something which has been used by different peoples to try and inflict harm on people. I never thought it would be seen as a Muslim-specific problem. But yeah, he dealt with that, the imam, did he?
And we dealt with that. We dealt with many other. There was about seven
misconceptions.
Yeah. And we cleared those up. Anybody who wants to go and see what actually was talked about, they can go and they can look
that
up.
That's another video you've done.
Yeah, we did that. But now it's interesting. We were talking a little bit, and you mentioned Joe, and I. That's very interesting. He's wearing our shirt. He's wearing that's actually my last name on his shirt in one of his shows, and that's not Photoshop.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. What do you think?
I think honestly, this is because Joe Rogan. He's obviously going out. He's got a lot of followers. He's not going to actually put that T-shirt on unless he's done it strategically. I don't believe he's that kind of a haphazard, slapdash kind of human being.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it was a message, and I think it was a positive message. And I think Joe Rogan respects people who are Muslim and are kind of practitioners of martial art.
Mm-hmm.
Like he respects Khabib, he respects, I think he respects you, he respects other people he's mentioned, Muslims, in his shows, in his podcast. So I think this is a kind of like a peace offering. I do think that.
Yeah. Mm. Well, we really want him to. In our last video, we sent that message that, hey, we'd love for you to talk about Islam.
Yeah.
You know, we'd love for us to be a part of the conversation, though.
Right.
So to have someone, like I mentioned, the imam that was here last time, invite him, hey, I can be your hookup. Mm-hmm. I can make it happen. Mm-hmm. A lot of times, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt.
Yeah.
Maybe you can't reach these people. You don't have the connections.
Right.
But now he's got the connection from the Dean Show. He's got me. Now you. Mm-hmm. So hopefully, what we want to do with this program, how about we go through some, because it looks like... His work, you know, that he's done has affected a lot of people, and many people have also brought to our attention some other things that he's said, right?
Mm-hmm.
So maybe we can go through some of these videos.
Yeah, sounds great.
What do you think?
No, it sounds great.
And at the end, with the intention that maybe he can invite you.
Inshallah.
We can go down together.
We can go down.
Train some jiu-jitsu, hang out. Maybe he's got some recipes. All in the essence of peace and understanding, right?
Yeah, excellent.
All right, so why don't we start with the first video, and then we can go from there. Huh?
Okay.
We're going to have a lot of fun on this episode. God willing, Joe Rogan, he can go through this also. It'll be a lot of fun for him as well and many of his viewers. Let's go to the first one, and then we'll get your comments on that.
Inshallah.
The term radical Islam gets thrown around.
Right. So radical Islam simply means I really take my Islam seriously. Right. It's let's draw a silly analogy.
Mm-hmm. Should we keep it going or that's good?
Yeah. I mean, that's fine. I mean,
okay. So you've heard that. So pretty much... you can interpret that, and I think this one, just the title in itself, I don't know if he puts this or people who work with him, but you know, just the title where this one is at, it's called The Dangers of Islam.
Right.
So just by the title itself, it's like, you know, putting Islam under the bus.
Mm-hmm.
And now this person who he brings on frequently, he pretty much says it, pretty much if you practice Islam, that's what it translates to, you know, you're pretty much a radical. So he's pretty much labeling all 1.7 million Muslim or any of those that are praying, giving in charity, trying to be a good human being, a good Muslim, he's radical.
Right. Well, first and foremost, it's really important for us to understand what he means by radical. In the West, when this term is used, radical Muslim or radical Islam, it means someone who is actually prone to violence or someone who has the propensity to violence or is violent in his or her actions. That's the connotation that is actually associated with the term radical Islam. So what he's trying to say is that in the normative position for a Muslim is that that particular Muslim is prone to violence with all peoples. And this is his opinion. If you keep watching what he says, his opinion is that if Muslims had it their way,
we would actually be violent to combatants and non-combatants, to women and children, to anyone who doesn't agree with our ideology. And the first thing is, he's made an assertion. He's now made a claim. Where is the evidence for this claim? Because making points on a podcast is one thing. Not being able to substantiate it with the primary source material, which is the Quran and Sunnah, is something which is actually should not be tolerated in an academic discussion. So from this perspective, Joe Rogan should have stopped everything going on there and said, okay, so what's the evidence for this? Since what Joe loves is enlightenment thinking, rationalism, all these kind of things. At every stage where claims are being made, evidence must be given to substantiate those claims. His claim is that Muslims are prone to violence, or radical Islam is Islam. In other words, what is commonly in the vernacular referred to as terroristic Islam, that is synonymous with the Islamic religion. Where's the evidence for that? So that's what I would start by saying, because you've made the claim, so what's the evidence for that?
And what is, I mean, so pretty much you have somebody here who's, now you have a platform that people are trusting you, right, with this information that you're disseminating.
Yeah.
And is this guy, is he spewing facts or fairy tales or fiction? What's this guy saying?
He's trying to imply, as we know from his viewpoint, that Muslims are prone to violence with non-Muslims.
So I said, fairy tales, you know, many cases, fairy tales aren't dangerous. You know, right. You can tell your kid a fairy tale bedtime, but these are, I mean, this stuff is dangerous now. Yeah. Is it?
It's absolutely dangerous, because if people actually buy into this propaganda, then this will affect the life chances of Muslims, where people will now compartmentalize the normal, we will say the normative Muslim, the Muslim who's living by the Quran and Sunnah, who's orthodox, who is living by the tenets of Islam and the injunctions of prescribed by the Quran and Sunnah. People will now, according to this, who have no knowledge or have no exposure to Islam, see that person as somewhat of a threat to their way of living, to their person, to the actual person. So without evidence, this kind of claim to be actually put on air on a massive podcast like Joe Rogan's podcast is, to be honest with you, a very irresponsible thing for Joe Rogan to acquiesce to and to allow to happen on his podcast.
How can he make it right?
He can make it right by every time there is a claim like this by one of those antagonists, and I would call them antagonists, or people that are anti-Islam, first and foremost, to ask them what the evidence for that claim is. And secondly, as you've mentioned at the beginning of this show, he has to now allow for Muslims to be able to put the argument, because he's never had a Muslim, pro-Islam, orthodox Muslim, on the show, putting forward the case for Islam and answering the questions and the misconceptions.
You ready to go? Yeah. He gives us the call. Mohammed Hijab and Eddie from the Dean Show, we're coming with our geese, Joe. Let's do it. Let's go to the next one.
Not always have been threatened in that my head is going to come off at any minute, right? My parents grew up and lived there. They didn't die. But once the Civil War broke out, then it became lethally dangerous to be Jewish. I mean, we were going to be executed. We left. So you never know when we're going to go from tolerating you to off with the heads. And that's been the history for the past 1,400 years.
So pretty much he's talking about we just never know when they're going to flip. We can translate it like that?
Right.
What do you got to say?
So there's two things with this, really important things that ought to be really stressed. One is that now he's making it as if Muslims are intrinsically violent and that you don't know when they are going to actually become violent. The question is, why would that be your assumption of only Muslims? There are segments of Muslims, we're not denying that there are some Muslims that are prone to violence, that have been violent, that continue to be violent. But is that an exclusively Muslim problem? That's point one. Number two is, where is, once again, your claim is noticeable by its lack of evidence. So in other words, in order to make this claim, where is your evidence from the Quran and Sunnah? Because once again, you're conflating Islam and Muslims. Islam as a religion, there is enough in the religion to make it patently clear to anyone who has a sincere mind and a pure heart and who's receptive to listening to these arguments, that Islam is categorically against the killing of innocent, or let's not even use the word innocent, non-combatant people. Because the word innocent could be said, okay, well, it's subjective. What does the word innocent mean? We are saying non-combatants. And what is the evidence of this? A hadith that is narrated by the Prophet Muhammad, where it says, "Man qatala mu'ahidan lam yarih ra'ihat al-jannah." Whoever kills a non-combatant non-Muslim will never smell the fragrance of heaven.
Why have I translated it as non-combatant, non-Muslim? Because this hadith, which is in Bukhari, is a sahih hadith, authentic, has been narrated upon by Ibn Hajar al-Asqalani, one of the scholars of Islam, major scholars who wrote Fath al-Bari, one of the major commentaries, probably the best to have written about the Bukhari, this collection, the most authoritative book of hadith according to Sunni Muslims. He says, a mu'ahad here in this hadith means a dhimmi, it means a mu'ahad al-mustamin. So in other words, any non-Muslim who is a non-combatant. That's the summary. So if the Prophet is telling us that you will never smell the fragrance of paradise if you attempt to murder, or if you murder a non-combatant, non-Muslim, and this man is saying Muslims are prone to violence, and he's indicating that potentially that violence comes from the Islamic sources, then does that not run counter to this particular hadith? Not regarding, of course, the Quran, what it says in chapter 60, verse 8, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, لَا يَنْهَاكُمُ اللَّهِ عَنَ الَّذِينَ لَمْ يُقَاتِلُوكُمْ فِي الدِّينِ وَلَمْ يُخْرِجُوكُمْ مِنْ دِيَارُكُمْ أَنْ تَبَرُّوهُمْ وَتُقْسِتُوا إِلَيْهِمْ إِنَّ اللَّهَ يُحِبُّ الْمُقْسِتِينَ. That Allah does not forbid you of being nice and kind to those non-believers who do not take you out of your homes or try and kill you. And that certainly Allah loves those who are just. This particular verse in the Quran is not abrogated. No scholar has said it's abrogated. No mufassir, no exegete applying the hermeneutical approach has said that this verse is abrogated. Therefore, with this verse and this hadith, and of course the many other verses in the Quran, like 532, chapter 5, verse 32, and other verses, it's categorically clear that the Islamic position is that it is not allowed. It is not allowed for a Muslim to endanger or kill or murder a non-Muslim who is a non-combatant. In any case, this runs counter to this man's claim.
Now, any other verses that are mentioned in the verbatim word of God, the Quran, where we have intact, tamper-free, tamper-proof, yes, as we had it revealed over 1400 years ago, we have it. Mm-hmm. There's no other book like it.
Yeah.
There are references in there, mm-hmm, and there's verses that people will take a lot of times out of context. So how do you now, for the skeptic, maybe Joe or one of his followers, they say, well, what about
Those verses.
How do you read those, interpret those verses?
Well, there's two things that need to be looked at. We are not denied. Well, first of all, Muslim position is not a pacifistic one. And that has to be made patently clear. That Islam is not a religion of pacifism. In other words, we do believe that there is a scope, an international scope from an international perspective, an international relations perspective, for defensive, and sometimes, historically, there have been preemptive excursions. And that's happened. There's been campaigns. We're not saying that didn't happen, and we wouldn't deny that that happened. That did happen. That is part of the Islamic corpus. There are verses in the Quran which encourage, in the context of war, for aggression. There is, for example, in chapter 8, verse number 12 and 13, it says, سَأُلْقِي فِي قُلُوبِ الَّذِينَ كَفَرُوا الرُّعْبَ فَضْرِبُوا فَوْقِ الْأَعْنَاقِ وَضْرِبُوا مِنْهُمْ مِنْ كُلِّ بَنَانٍ, which is very much parroted by a lot of these Islamophobes, which says that I will put in the hearts of the disbelievers terror. So, you know, hit them at the necks and hit them at the fingertips. What is this talking about? It's very, very clear that chapter 8 of the Quran, chapter 9, chapter 4, chapter 2, all those places and those places in the Quran which talk about violence, reference the context of war.
This is combat now.
Only combat. And you know what the evidence of this is? And this is something which, unfortunately, and this man is meant to be an Arab, but I don't think he's familiar with these things. I will challenge anyone actually on this, yeah? There is no place in the Quran where the word, where killing is mentioned of someone who's a non-Muslim without at least the beginning of that particular segment, a reference to qital being made. Now the word qital in Arabic, it necessitates fighting from both sides. It has to have fighting from both sides. Qital means fighting from both sides. Whenever the Quran mentions fighting or killing, it only does so when it's clear that the one who you're fighting is a combatant that is intending to endanger you and endanger your life and endanger your property. Not in the context where that person is a non-combatant. That is clear in the linguistic, what you would call the meter. This is called the meter, the Arabic meter of this particular word, qital. It cannot mean one person murdering another person who is a non-combatant. It necessitates in the Arabic language that there is fighting from both sides. So everywhere in the Quran, which talks about fighting, only does so in the context of war. And this is absolutely non-controversial, considering that that is the foreign policy of almost every, if not every country in the world today. It's absolutely not controversial. But they've made it controversial because they need to stigmatize the other. And today, the other is the Muslim.
Let's go to the next clip. We got quite a few to go through. Let's go. You ready for the next one?
Yeah.
This shirt actually looks good on Joe, doesn't it?
It does.
Right?
It kind of complements his physique.
Yeah. We can get you another one. Joe, hopefully when we come down, when he invites Mohammed Hijab and myself, will come down. Or you can invite him. We get you someone else.
No, we need you to come. We need you to come as well.
We'll come together, inshallah. Let's go to the next one.
Very odd because it's the most regressive.
It's unbelievable.
It's a really strange position to be a progressive who's reinforcing the ideologies of a regressive culture that's very ancient.
But what's incredible is that they'll come up with ways to defend this cognitive inconsistency. And hence, that's part of the ostrich parasitic syndrome that I was mentioning earlier.
What are some ways that they defend it?
So, example. Let me just give you a few manifestations of ostrich logic. My friend Muhammad is a very nice guy, and he drinks, and he fornicates, and he's very liberal. So the idea then becomes that as long as I can identify a single exemplar of an Islamic person who does not otherwise adhere to what Islam dictates, then it's not true that Islam is bad. Now, this is a manifestation of a more general cognitive bias.
Your feedback on this?
So I would say that...
What's he saying? You sum it up for the average layman. They're like, they can't maybe make out what we're trying to deduce from here.
Right.
What is, in layman's terms, what message are we getting from this?
What he's trying to say, that anything in his opinion which complies with his definition of progression is good. Islam does not comply with that. Therefore, Islam is bad. That's his deduction, right?
He's saying that Islam is regressive.
Regressive.
That means it's in the Stone Age.
Yes, in the Stone Age. It's a medieval religion.
Yeah.
Right. So he makes his point quite often. Actually, he says it's very archaic, very medieval, very ancient religion. This, by the way, in logic is called the genetic fallacy. Genetic fallacy is basically to say, and this is it's a textbook in formal fallacy. It's one of the first things anyone will learn if they've studied the basics of logic. Now, he makes this point over and over again that this is an ancient religion, a very old religion, or whatever. I mean, so what? Does that take away, depreciate from its truth value? Because actually, democracy is more aged than Islam. Islam with the big I, that which we would say that the coming of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, democracy was exercised in the ancient Greek period of time. So this was a good maybe 1,000 years before Islam, or something actually more than that. So we're talking about, if that was the logic, you're a liberal democrat with small l and small d, right? You believe in liberalism and you believe in democracy. Yet liberalism, or you can say democracy for sure, is an ancient belief. And he makes this point once again. So does that make democracy an unuseful way of life? So once again, the genetic fallacy is it doesn't actually yield any positive results. The second thing is, here, he's allowed for his, basically I would say the ruler, by which and through which he measures truth, the post-enlightenment age, which is basically after there was a philosophical age in the 1900s, whereby some philosophers came and they preached certain philosophies of them. Liberalism was refined. Lots of republicanism was defined, refined. Lots of popular philosophies were kind of refined at that period of time. And he thinks the judge of a good society is that which is complicit with those particular philosophies. My question would be, what's the proof for that? What's the evidence for that? So you've taken for granted that the Enlightenment age is the be-all and end-all, is the pinnacle of human achievement, is the philosophical peak. Now, what is the objective, in an objective way? So what is your way of dealing with that? What is your evidence base for that? How can you provide evidence for that? In fact, if you look at the Enlightenment period, most of the philosophers actually disagreed with each other on very core tenets. And that's why you had that conglomerate of different philosophers always disagreeing with each other on core issues. Thus, your measure of truth is really a subjective measure of truth, which relies only upon I would say, the post-colonial white man's world. And this is very much the way that the colonialist, the British colonialist, the French colonialist, the Italian colonialist, the German colonialist, all of these European colonialists, the Dutch colonialists, they actually justified colonizing lands. And that's how America was actually, in a sense, formed. So if that is the case, my question to you very directly, Joe, would be, how can you prove it? Why? How can you prove your implicit assumption here that progression is that which goes towards Western civilization or its understanding of enlightenment, etc.? How can you prove that? Because we can't just take those premises for granted.
Don't we see people judging like Islam and the civilization of Islam based on two countries? And specifically, you have Afghanistan and Iraq, which have been like blown back into the Stone Age.
Right.
So they look at those places where they've been just bombed, you know, and the people who are living peacefully, right? Mm-hmm. And now minding their own business.
Yeah.
Now we went over there, just turned everything into... How many people died over there? Innocent people.
In Iraq, some of the statistics say 123,000, 125,000 people died. Some say goes up from the ranging statistics. Some say 125,000 goes up to a million. So there are ranging statistics, but that's a massive number.
Massive, yeah.
That's a massive number which cannot be compared to anything, and we're not justifying by anything that the terrorists have done. So those terrorists, the Islamic terrorists, what they have done in terms of human casualty doesn't compare to just that one particular war.
So you blew up burned the books in the libraries, you know, everything was just destroyed. The country's upside down.
Absolutely.
So people think, okay, well, this is Islam. They're backward. But right. Are there some modern days examples of some countries that Muslims are living in? I mean, what examples do you give? You got Dubai. Where would you give examples?
That's a good question. So I would say, generally speaking, I wouldn't premise this by saying that the measure of an advanced society is necessarily developmental or economic, right? But even if we did look at economic, even if we did take that as a kind of measure, there are some cities and some countries now in the Muslim world, like in Malaysia, like in Indonesia, like in Turkey, like in different countries, like you say UAE. These are countries which are growing at a rapid rate. However, who cares? It doesn't do anything to prove, reduce, increase the truth value of Islam or any other religion. Look at where America was a good 100 years ago. There was the Wall Street crash in the Great Depression. This was literally 100 years ago. I mean, we're talking about the 1920s and 30s, the Wall Street crash in the Great Depression. Does that mean that the values that you take so much for granted were false then and they're true now? Does economic growth and sustainability necessitate truth? I think this is actually something that a lot of people do believe. That if something, if the values of a particular country are good, then the economics will be good. And that's something he said in another segment or one of his guests said it. It's a very false kind of fallacious type logic. China should be at the forefront of our analysis then. Whatever they believe, it must be the truth. Mm-hmm. Because according to many different economists, they're saying that China will actually overtake America in its overall GDP and will overtake it even militarily in 100 years or 50 years.
One more point. What about when Islam was at its, what they call, golden age?
Yeah.
When you look at Islam was now in Spain and places like this.
Right.
How advanced, how they say progressive, was it regressive back then? Or
that's
was
really
the rest of the world where people were in the dark ages? What happened if you use this example?
Well, that's a really good question, because I would argue that if you look at, for example, the time period of about 410 AD to 1485 AD, this is what is commonly referred to as the Middle Ages. Yeah, the Middle Ages is also referred to, ironically, as the European Dark Ages. And the reason why they call it that is literally because the Europeans didn't have, at that particular time, much of a cultural, economic, or philosophical contribution on the world. And in fact, the superpowers of the world were not the Western world. After 1485, there was a massive shift because basically the Europeans found the Americas. And that was the age of the discovery. And the Renaissance also started. The early modern period started. There's lots of different things that started at the same time. But if you think about the period of time that I've just mentioned, the Abbasid Empire, for example, was seen as the strongest human empire in the world. And so if we use the same logic, we have to look at the historical timeline. One of his arguments, one of the arguments that his panelists oftentimes make, is that economic growth is a measure of truth. Well, if that's the case, we have to look at all of the time. And this is a false premise anyways, but look at all the time. And the Quran actually informs us of the fact that there will be days and there will be times where non-Muslims will be successful, whether it be militarily or economically, and Muslims will be successful economically and militarily. In his Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he says, وَتِلْكَ الْأَيَّامُ نُدَاوِلَهَا بَيْنَ النَّاسِ, these are the days which we alternate between the people.
Yes.
So in other words, there'll be some days which you'll be prosperous and victorious, and other days which you'll be which you will not be prosperous and victorious.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the next one.
That does not want to criticize this one segment of the human population that they think is being persecuted.
Right. And so, meanwhile, if you think about throughout currently in the world, which ideology persecutes the most number of other people? So if you talk about bloody borders, right? Islam has fought with Buddhists. Islam fights with animists. Islam fights with Jews. Islam fights with Christians. Islam fights with Tibetan monks.
Damn, man. He just makes Muslims are just bullies. They just, oh, wow. They're just, you know, bloody.
Unbelievable.
And blood they're looking for a fight. Why, everywhere you go, Muslims are fighting with Buddhists, Tibetans, Jew, everybody. He just started to, you know, list goes on. What do you got to say?
Well, I would say to that that's a really unfair social analysis. In fact, that's actually very, if anything's going to make us angry, is that. Because frankly, the first example he gave was a ridiculous example. He says Muslims, and to paraphrase him, has fought with Buddhists. Muslims has fought with Buddhists. I mean, really? If you look at the situation in Burma, who is fighting with who? Who is the oppressed and who is the oppressor in Burma? Burma is a Buddhist majority country. The Rohingya are a Muslim minority living in Burma. According to the UN, they are the most persecuted people in the world. This is happening today. It happened yesterday and it's going to happen tomorrow. So
who picked that fight?
Exactly. That's a really good question. So who picked that fight? It was a fight that was initiated by the military, the Burmese military, under the command of the Burmese government, and with the support of some Burmese people. I'm being very careful. Some Burmese people. And particularly the clerics, the monks. Some monks have come out, and the documentaries are online. It's not private. Have come out and actually justified this genocide that's happening now. And what's happening, I've been there myself. I went to Cox Bazar, which was on the border with Burma. It's on my channel, actually. I've got a video with women who I've done personal interviews with in Burma. And these women were telling me that they've seen that their sons have been thrown into fires. Basically, fires were made by the military. And the Burmese government, Burmese military, held their sons, their small infant sons, and threw them into fires. And this happened en masse in villages. Whole villages were burnt down. I was a witness to that. And it's on my channel. I'll maybe send you a link of that. But it's very clear for everyone to see that actually what's going on is a genocide the other way around. And then he mentions Muslims are fighting with Jews. Is this the argument that actually Jews are not fighting with Muslims? Because frankly, if we look at the situation from the Balfour Declaration up until this point in time, in Israel, what's referred to as Israel, in Palestine, which we refer to as Palestine, which is now not recognized as a country, the country's been taken over. It's been complete, and now settlements are being built in the West Bank, in that area. So, and these are Muslim people that are living there, being kicked out of their homes, and being persecuted. And in fact, many people would argue, non-Muslims would fairly argue, looking at it objectively, as Joe would say, that actually there's no doubt that the oppressed here are the Palestinians, and the oppressor are those people that are pinching the Palestinians from every corner. So that's what's happening. And then he mentions Muslims have fought with Christians. Almost every historian that I've read on the Crusades, by the way, they see especially the First and Second Crusade as a very bloody endeavor, which was obviously initiated by the Christians and was continual. So in other words, Christians continued doing this. Yet the mention of the Crusades is not mentioned. The colonization of the Americas was one of the most bloodiest wars, because it was a series of wars, proxy wars and wars, in human history. The colonization of Spain, by Spain, of the Americas, of South America, and of Western European countries to North America. This was seen as one of the most bloodiest things that has ever happened in human history. And this is recent history. Look what, how black people were treated in America, enslaved for many, many years, and racially abused and persecuted. And a lot of this was pretext using biblical script.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of people use Genesis chapter 9, verse 22 to show, oh, look, you know, Ham is the son of Noah and he was cursed. And therefore, racism is okay. So why is this discussion not coming out? Why is this not being fleshed out? Why is this kind of whole scale, like a holistic approach, not being taken sociologically and more of a wide scale historical inquiry being made on this? Why does it have to be very cherry picked? And this is another logical fallacy, by the way, examples to try and prove that Muslims are unique in their violence. In fact, if you look at the most bloodiest, if you look at the bloodiest wars that have ever happened in history, look at the top 10 in terms of casualties, you'll find that the majority of them were done by Europeans and its extensions. So does that mean to say that white people now, white Europeans, are the bloodiest and most violent people in the world? The historical record shows that they are. But is that something in their genetics? We wouldn't make that argument. We would say that would be a ridiculous argument. It was circumstantial. It was politically circumstantial. So I would say the same thing. Islam now is being vilified because of the political or geopolitical situation which has happened, which has made, which has allowed for certain groups to form and certain terroristic acts to take place. That's politically circumstantial. But if you compare that with what's happened broadly in history, we're very, very clear that actually it's a drop in the ocean compared to the amount of people that have been killed by the Europeans under not only Christianity, but all of those Enlightenment philosophies that Joe loves so much, including liberalism, including secularism, and including atheism, materialism, that Islam has no, there's no comparison in terms of casualties.
Yeah, it seems like many of these guests, they're not thoroughly educated in this area.
Yeah.
And they take these headline, they educate themselves because they have a certain agenda. And we know that today there's a big industry. People are making a lot of money
on
bashing Islam. It's the Islamophobia industry. Mm-hmm. But then you have people that, so let's say, okay, that's coming from you guys, the Muslims, right?
Yeah.
But people can go and check into this like someone who is genuine and sincere, who's a friend of Joe Rogan's, mm-hmm. right? His name is CJ Wheelerman.
Mm-hmm.
He's been on the Joe Rogan show.
Mm-hmm.
He was someone who was also kind of just going along with what, you know, the tabloids and, you know, superficial knowledge. But he went into depth and he wanted to know, hold on, what is causing these people to go ahead, you know, a certain fringe element to do whatever extremist acts.
Mm.
And now he's bringing to light, he's saying that, no, it's not because of Islam. It is geopolitical. You're mm-hmm. going exploiting these people's lands, their resources. And then he also is now on the forefront, C.J. Right. Wheelerman.
Wow.
Guest on the Joe Rogan show. He's a friend of Joe Rogan's. He's also now coming out and speaking on behalf of the Burmese people. Anyone who is a sincere, genuine person, who has a heart, right, who really is out for justice, for truth,
mm-hmm.
right, who's not just trying to maliciously spread hate and whatnot,
mm-hmm.
he's going to see these things are, this is a rabbit hole you go down and you see. It's like, wow, you know, these are things that I don't really hear in the mainstream. CJ Wheelerman, he's someone now who brings to the forefront the oppression, the genocide that's going against the Burmese people.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the Zionists, with the Palestinian, the oppression that's going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And I really think that Joe Rogan, if he starts to bring on people like yourself, people like, I don't think CJ's been on his show again because he had an epiphany. He's like, you know, started to really truth seek and he went down this direction. I don't know if he'll have him back again. But if he brings on people like that, like yourself and others, he'll have more of a balanced approach.
Yeah, I hope so. Well, yeah. I do. I really hope. Because the thing is, at the moment, his choice of panelists have been very, very selective. I mean, he's chosen people that literally are anti-Muslim, ex-Muslim.
And it shouldn't be like our team against your team. We're like one humanity.
Exactly, yeah.
Right? It shouldn't be like, okay, now, you know, they're the other, they're the bad guys, and now we're trying to stack all the chips against them, so I bring on these selective guests. What should be the criteria here?
Mm.
What should we be looking for? For truth, no?
Right, right.
For justice, for truth.
Yeah.
And how would you recommend to Joe right now to ascertain that truth?
I'll say to him, I genuinely believe from what I've seen with Joe and with his guests, especially the ones who talk about Islam, that he's asking from a sincere position of, I'm not going to say this in a derogatory sense, but of ignorance. Like, he doesn't know something, he wants to know. And he's sincere about that. What I would say to him is that don't rely upon that testimony, because what would be more conducive for you is to pick up a translation of the meaning of the Quran. Read at least from chapter 50 up until chapter 114, which is a section called Al-Mufassal. It will give you an understanding of the core tenets of Islam. If you can read the whole book in the translation of the meanings, I'll say to him, listen to our side of the argument as well. Listen to what we do. Try and put yourself in a position, because Joe, you're an advocate. He's an advocate of taking himself out of the his comfort zone. He's a martial artist. He believes in a sustained growth cannot be achieved unless you take yourself out of your comfort zone. And the same thing applies ideologically. You will not be able to grow intellectually until you surround yourself with people you disagree with.
Yeah.
And that's what we do on a regular basis in the UK. We go to a place called Speaker's Corner, and we speak with people we disagree with.
Hyde Park, right?
Hyde Park, Speaker's Corner. And that is a very... It's actually a liberating experience, because we're able to flesh these issues out and take the elephant out of the room. So I would recommend for you, for your own intellectual growth, and for your own, I would even say, psycho-spiritual growth.
I like that. And he can relate to that, because in jiu-jitsu, right, if you're just training with the same training partners, right, you're beating out on them, right, you're not challenging yourself, putting yourself in uncomfortable positions, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You're not going to grow.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's a good point. Let's go, let's continue on. How's that? We got a few more. Let's go through these.
Is that let people who are non-Islamic, who are fleeing those areas, at the front of the queue first.
But isn't that religious persecution? I mean, or at the very least, it's prejudiced, right? I mean, you're singling people out because of their ideology or because of what religion they're from, not because of their past behavior or any predictors whatsoever about their future behavior.
But we do have some statistical regularity about what types of values those guys are going to come with. So I'm not suggesting we close the door.
Right, but wouldn't that in a way, I mean, just to play devil's advocate, wouldn't that in a way kind of put the Muslims in Toronto who do immigrant, which would have picked that city, who tried to immigrate to Canada, in the same sort of a position that your family was in Lebanon, where you were hiding the fact that you were Jews?
No one has an inalienable right to immigrate anywhere, correct? So if you wish to immigrate to the West, then leave every single syllable that constitutes a belief, attitude, position, value that is contrary to ours at the door, and then welcome in my brother.
But man, isn't that a crazy thing to say to someone whose entire life and their ideology is a big part of their identity and who they are, like how they view the world. So that's the structure for which they interface with other human beings.
But if those values, so let's suppose they were.
I agree with you in a way. I agree with you overall when I talk about the entire human population that it would be wonderful if we did that. But from individual to individual, we know about the trials and tribulations that people go through in a day-to-day life. And religious freedom and a religious ideology in many cases helps people get through the pains of life. It helps them get through the struggles.
So now what you have here, I would say this guy is an anti-constitutionalist.
Right.
Because in our constitution,
yeah,
you have what? Freedom of religion. So can we say that this guy is saying basically you can come to America but leave your Islam?
Yeah, that's exactly what he's trying to say, isn't it? Yeah.
What do you have to say about this?
Well, I think that's more in line. I'm not saying this guy is this, but that's more in line with a fascist belief rather than a liberal belief, frankly. Because fascism comes from the word fascio, which literally means to bundle everyone up together and to rule over them with the same ideology. So in other words, a uniformity in the way everyone, what everyone believes is required in fascism. People like Carl Schmitt talked about this, one of the fascist Nazi philosophers. So what he's saying is more in line with that than is in line with liberalism. To be fair to Joe, though, he did actually disagree with the sentiment, which is good, obviously.
The good was coming out. Joe was standing up. I mean, for some of the American principles, right?
Right.
He was saying I was trying to play devil's advocate, but I think his good side that was coming out.
Yeah,
he was trying
to, you know. Out. I think he's reluctant to disagree with his guest.
Yeah.
Right. He's reluctant to disagree with him, but he was playing this devil's advocate, but he was saying, I agree with parts of it, which implied he disagreed with parts of what this man was saying.
Sometimes you got to change your friends, brother, if you want to grow also. You just can't be around the same people. It's They're going to bring you down.
It's true.
This guy's spreading hate, man.
It's true. Yeah. He's saying basically, do you know what? The significance of what he's saying is that people who are fleeing persecution, because that's what's happening. They're fleeing, they're Muslims who are fleeing persecution, that are dying, women and children who are coming. What if this man had it his way, because he was talking about how Muslims would have it their way. If this man had it his way, we'd have to apostate from our religion in order to enter into a safe zone.
Yeah.
Sounds very constitutionalist or pro-constitution. I don't think so. I think this man is very, as you've said correctly, anti-constitution.
Yeah. Let's go to the next one.
Yes.
I haven't been everywhere, so I'm pretty well traveled. I've never been anywhere like my time in the Middle East where I've seen, not everybody, but certain people value human life so little. So little.
Okay, maybe he's talking about the people where he visited there, but am I understanding this right, that is he classifying Muslims as people that he's never seen such a group of people as Muslims who don't have value for human life?
He was talking about Middle Eastern as Arabs. Yeah. But generally speaking, I think the conversation went on to include all Muslims.
Yeah.
And the implicit or the subtextual thing there was that Islam was the cause of this. This is what they believe, and this is what's kind of echoed before with the other guest. The point being is this. I mean, he's saying that he's never seen a people that have not valued human life so little. Well, I don't see how that could be the case when you have police officers shooting black people in this country, left, right, and center, for racial reasons. I don't see how that could be the case when America, since 2015, which is some 2-3 years ago, was responsible for 1,358 drone strikes in Afghanistan alone. I don't see how that's the case when Stephen Green, one of the people that was in Iraq, one of the human beings that was an ex-drone member of Iraq, he killed and raped a 14-year-old Iraqi girl. And when asked the reason why, he said, "I don't see that Iraqis are human beings." And that is the essence of dehumanization. I don't see how he thinks that Middle Easterners are literally unique in their belief that human life is less. When actually the reason why the majority of human life blood has been spilt in the Middle East is actually because of America itself. 123,000 people have died in Iraq alone. So his point is absolutely null and voided. He's shooting himself right in the foot with that, because frankly, what America has done in the last 100 years in terms of war, Korea, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, and more, and you know, the drone strike campaigns, is unmatchable. It's absolutely unmatchable. But the thing is this, I think they differentiate in their minds between people who are close by and people who are further away. Because they don't necessarily see the drones and they don't necessarily see the people being killed, they don't necessarily have that intimate, empathetic relationship with the rest of humanity. What we're saying is, before you point the finger at Middle Easterners and Muslims and all these people, realize very clearly that there are fingers pointing back at you. Be introspective, because this is a very unfair sociological analysis.
Before we go to the next one, me as a Muslim who loves Islam, submission to the will of God. Mm. A Muslim is one who submits to the will of God, who loves Jesus, who loves Moses, all the prophets that God has sent with the same message: worship only the Creator, not the creation. Do good deeds. One of the first things I think about, three, and then we'll go to the next one real quick, is the first thing, that one of the cases that will be judged on the Day of Judgment is someone who has blood on their hands.
Allah.
And that's scary. I know it's scary for me. I'm sure it's scary for you.
Absolutely.
You don't want to come in front of the Creator, in front of Allah, in front of God with human life on your hand. We know that, right?
Yes,
that is going to be something where you don't want to take a chance, right? Mm-hmm. And then you have the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, who shows us through our example that a woman, she'll be thrown in the hellfire because she neglected to feed her cat.
Subhanallah.
Her cat. She oppressed the cat. And that, what does that teach us? That teaches the value of not just human life, of animal life. And then on top of that, you have the mercy of Islam that the person who went, it was a prostitute, was
yes,
it?
Yes.
Who gave water
to the dog.
To the dog, right. Look at them. See, so these people are ignorant of Islam.
Yeah.
You know, they're
in fact, this other guy, he was saying that Prophet Muhammad hates dogs.
You're a not, black dog?
Yeah, I mean, Muhammad hated dogs, but he particularly hated black dogs.
Right?
Yeah.
So
that hadith has no place in his analysis.
Yeah, so this knocks that out. We don't even have to go to that. Yeah. All right, let's go to the next one.
No, you can... Slavery... I mean, this is the horror of Abrahamic religion generally. I mean, this is why we know these are books were not authored by a moral genius. The Bible and the Quran can't give you a basis to resist slavery.
Take it away.
So this is really interesting because Sam Harris has actually written a book called The Moral Landscape. And in that book called The Moral Landscape, he writes in a footnote, in one of the ending chapters, I forget which chapter exactly, but he writes, and this is a kind of paraphrase of what he says. He says that there is no neurobiological way of ascertaining truth and falsehood. In other words, objective morality, according to Sam Harris, cannot be ascertained on the atheistic, materialistic worldview. This is not just Sam Harris's opinion. This is the opinion of Richard Dawkins, of Jacques Derrida, of Bertrand Russell, of Nietzsche, of most postmodernist atheist philosophers, that actually objective morality cannot be ascertained. What's really interesting is that on the one hand, where they make this patently clear, that there is no philosophical epistemological base for basically believing an objective morality, they'll make arguments which are moral against religion. And this is one of the arguments that they made. So he makes, he says that the slavery and whatnot. Let's take for granted, let's say for the sake of argument, that he's right about this, about slavery generally speaking. Even if he was completely right, that would do absolutely nothing for the case of atheism and absolutely nothing for disproving Islam. However, he is wrong on that because of one very simple verse in the Quran, which most of the children, our children, have memorized, in Surah Al-Balad, in chapter 90 of the Quran, where it simply says, وَمَا أَدَرَاكَ مَا الْعَقَبَةَ فَكُّ رَقَبَةَ. What do you know of the good way? What would make you know what the good way is? Freeing slaves is the good way. His exact terminology was that there is nothing within or inside or outside of the scriptures which allows for the resisting of slavery. The Quran says very clearly that actually, وَمَا أَدْرَاكَ مَا الْعَقَبَةَ. What would make you know what the good way is? Freeing slaves is the good way. What he is saying, because he is, I believe, theologically illiterate. I don't think he's actually someone who reads books, theological books, Quran, Sunnah, Hadith, and these things. I don't think he actually even looks at the Bible too deeply. I think he makes sociological cases and generalizes them on the religion. And that's very, very much the nature of what he does. He never quotes the Quran. You'll never really see this guy quoting the Quran.
Sam Harris.
Sam Harris doesn't really quote the Quran. I've never seen him. I've never once seen him quoting the Quran because he knows it's muddy water for him. He's not trained on this. He shouldn't talk about this. He is what they call an ultra-crepidarian. He's a non-specialist talking about something which does not concern him. He's completely talking about something which is out of his lane. When he does the same thing with philosophy, it's the same thing. He's a non-specialist in philosophy, non-specialist in theology, but he talks about both those matters as if he is an authority on those two matters. So here, he said that the Quran, and I'm not talking about the Bible now, but we're talking about the Quran specifically, there's nothing in it that would allow us to resist slavery. So he would not be able to, explain away that verse, which is a non-abrogated verse of the Quran. Moreover, I guess what he's trying to say is, because there are verses of the Quran which talk about what your right hand possesses and these things, and the various ahadith in the seerah, which shows us that there were slaves at the time of the Prophet, and we're not denying that that's the case. Absolutely, there was slaves at the time of the Prophet. We are saying that the objective of Islam...
The whole world at that time...
Absolutely. Well, slavery ended in America in 1865. In Britain in 1807. That's legally. Once again, if we take a step back and say, what is slavery? The International Anti-Slavery Organization, they actually said that slavery is defined as, it includes child labor, human trafficking, and prostitution. They've said these things. If we consider these factors, and we're very serious about those definitions, and I would claim that the West is actually more involved and engaged with slavery than any other part of the world.
And I think that now, if you really care, if you really want to make a difference, since we live here, that's something that's not talked about. That's like our little secret, America's secret.
Absolutely,
here,
yeah.
That there are child sex slave rings Absolutely. In our country right now.
Up to 300,000 boys and girls are sold in the United States every year. And many of them don't make it out of the industry alive. There are only 99 known survivors from the state of Texas in the last 20 years who've managed to escape sexual slavery.
When we think of the most horrific of crimes, the ones so morally repugnant and barbaric, you know, the widespread ones that make you question humanity, it can help us cope to believe they happened somewhere else, somewhere far away. That's why this weekend's FBI prostitution sting and capture of over 150 pimps was so disturbing. Over 100 children rescued. Sexual slavery here at home. How does it still happen?
Right.
So now you want to go ahead and do some social good.
Yeah.
Joe Rogan should step up. Sam Harris should step up.
Talk about human trafficking.
And talk about human trafficking that's happening right here in our backyard.
Yeah.
But no, you got to go talk about, you know, this, that, things, the other.
Absolutely.
Point the finger that way so we don't have to really talk about what's going on at home.
It's really interesting because Polaris said that. Polaris is one of, I think it's called Polaris, one of the organizations. They said that America's engaged in slavery. The majority of people that they enslave in human trafficking forms is are actually people of ethnic minority descent, so black people, etc. Those people that are human engaged in the process of human trafficking, who are trafficked, are actually people of ethnic minorities. So they are actually oppressing minorities, enslaving people, going back to what they used to be the 1865 days, and talking to us about slavery. Islam is I would put this very candidly on the record. One of the objectives of Islam is to do away with the institution of slavery. The mechanism by which and through which it attempted to do this, which is what I was saying before, was an incremental gradualist method. It wasn't an instant abolition. And we know from history that, frankly, when abolitions are attempted, just like in this country when the abolition was attempted of alcohol, people rebel against it very quickly. If something as deep and as economically important as the institution of slavery is interwoven into the economic fiber of a society, it's not possible for you to pull the rug under someone's foot. So in other words, what Islam came with was an incremental method using different things, and of them is zakat. Because in Surah At-Tawbah, chapter 9 of the Quran, there are eight or nine things that are mentioned in the verse which talks about zakat, and one of them was wafir riqab, the people who are enslaved. So in other words, since zakat is one of the five pillars of Islam, and since this particular pillar must be continued until the day of judgment, we believe, then there must have been a certain amount of money always designated for the freeing of slaves. But of course, Sam Harris doesn't know this. Another thing which is really interesting is chapter 24, verse 33 of the Quran, which explicitly says that if at that particular time, it's obviously not not applicable to us, at that particular historical time period, something called mukataba can be done. Mukataba is where you literally have someone who's enslaved, and then they say to their slave owner, I want to be free, and I'll ransom myself. Okay, that person is not a criminal. That person is not someone who's done anything. According to chapter 24, verse 33, and you can look at, for example, Tafsir al-Qurtubi, or other tafsir, like exegesis, that explicitly say that there's an opinion that says, and this is a strong opinion, going back to the Sahaba and the companions of the Prophet, if this particular indentured servant, because they're not really slaves in the colloquial sense, because you think of slaves like racial slavery, we've never had that in Islam. That's never been part of Islamic.
Never.
Never, ever. Racial stuff, the Quran is very...
That's what people think. That's what they have in their head.
We're talking about indentured, because at the time there was no prisons. So these people were put into homes and imprisoned as if it was a prison, right? So that particular person, if they demand from the slave owner to be freed, then according to Tafsir al-Qurtubi and according to the Sahaba that are related by this tafsir, they must be freed. Even if the slave owner, or you can say the one who's the prisoner, the one who's imprisoning this indentured servant, declines it, this person can go to a qadi, can go to a judge and forcefully be liberated or emancipated. So in other words, Islam, I would argue, is the only ancient system which allowed for the freeing of people which were either slaves, indentured servants, or otherwise. There's nothing else in the history of man that went out of its way in order to get people out of the shackles of slavery and into and emancipate, generally speaking, whether it be Muslim or non-Muslim.
What comes to my mind, is it Zayd ibn Haritha? Mm. Was it, am I saying the right name, where when he was freed, mm-hmm. and then he had a chance to go back to his father, to his family, he chose
the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi
wasallam to stay, mm-hmm. you know, out of the love, mm-hmm. you know, out of the love that he had for Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him.
Yeah.
So you have a, when you put yourself, when you take yourself living in today's 2018, today's age, right? And then you take your back yourself back 1,400 years ago, when the whole world, everybody,
is immersed in slavery. Absolutely, everyone. Yeah.
But then Islam came to free the necks of the slaves, right?
Absolutely.
So if Islam just came and said, slavery is eradicated,
it wouldn't work.
It wouldn't work. You got people invested with millions, mm-hmm. hundreds of millions of dollars, you know, in slave business.
Absolutely.
But then what you're saying here is now, if I'm correct, now in every which way you turn, mm-hmm. it just made the road that now it penetrated the hearts.
Yeah.
So people gave this up.
Absolutely.
From the love of their hearts.
Absolutely.
Not like the, it was forced in this country. And to this day, mm-hmm. people are like, these people should be slaves, right?
SubhanAllah.
And you have all this racism.
Mm-hmm.
Is this correct?
Yeah, but there are certain situations where people will be forced to free slaves. For example, in Islam, if someone had sexual intercourse with their wife in Ramadan, they have to free a slave. If someone does dhihar, which is mentioned in chapter 58 of the Quran, which they call their wives, that they say that you're like my mother. In other words, you're not sexually compatible with me or something. It's a very specific kind of insult.
Free,
they have to free slaves.
Go.
Yeah, if they did, if they did an oath,
yeah.
they have to free. So there's so many things in Islam which you're forced to free slaves if you do certain things.
Then these slaves also, slaves,
right.
become governors, then they become scholars, then
yeah.
they become like, you
absolutely.
Know, had people of high prestige.
People will not understand this, but some people, and because we just said that, for example, if someone was enslaved or an indentured servant.
Indentured really, servant, that's really what it
yeah, yeah, that's what they were. They were indentured servants. If they were in the house of someone who was imprisoning them and they had the rights over them, let's say, and they decided that they wanted to do mukataba, which is this, basically it's a ransom. They're ransoming themselves. They want to be freed, and they had that opportunity and they didn't take it. The question is, why would those people not take it? A lot of the particular slaves at that time were indentured servants. They didn't take the opportunity because they were getting free accommodation.
Yes,
and that's why a lot of them continue to be mamalik. Like the Mamluk Empire was actually the Mamluks. There was two Mamluks, one in Egypt and one in India. But the ones in Egypt and in India, both of those were of a slave tribe or a slave socioeconomic grouping. So they were socioeconomically the lowest of the low, yet they were made into the highest of the high.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not the same as the Western experience. A lot of people think they generalize history. Say, okay, what happened to the transatlantic slave trade where you had black people shift over from West Africa?
Yeah.
That's the same thing as what happened with Islam. It's not.
Okay, before we go to the next one, people are automatically going to see what's going on with this insane state, right?
Yes.
They use these fringe elements and then some things in Libya.
Yeah.
What do you say to that?
I say to that, I mean, it's really, really interesting. The IS, Islamic State, we shouldn't call it that. We should call it Daesh or something, whatever they want to call themselves.
How about the insane state?
Insane, that sounds good, yeah.
Insane.
Those particular individuals, first and foremost, I've never seen such an extreme fringe in my whole life, to the extent whereby I watched an interview in Arabic with one of the, I'm not going to mention their names, but they're of the same ilk as Osama bin Laden, right?
Mm-hmm.
They're of the same ilk, meaning they have the same kind of, they believe in the same things. And one of their leaders said, we don't consider, this is exactly what he said. He said, we call this group back to Ahl Sunnah wal Jama'ah. So they don't consider them Sunni Muslims. Some scholars don't consider this particular faction, it's called Khawarij, Muslims. Some scholars have said that at all. So that's one thing. Those people who have said that, they don't consider, they're enslaving, and this is what this person said in the interview, they're enslaving their women. So in other words, that particular, another faction in the Assyrian war, which is, let's say, associated with extremism, that other faction was associated, he's saying, the person who's in charge of that faction, that they're enslaving our woman. What does that show? It shows, actually, to be frank, that no one sees these people as doing something in line with Islam, not even Osama bin Laden himself. And I'm saying this on the record. Not even him. And we know that what he stands for and all that kind of stuff is completely against mainstream Orthodox Islam, according to all of the institutions of Islam. But not even he would see what they're doing is in line with Islam.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
I could mention names and all these kind of things, but we won't go into that. We won't go into that discussion. But the point is, this is such a fringe element of Islam that it's really not worth mentioning as a point of reference. Yet Sam Harris consistently mentions it as some kind of point of reference. It's academically disingenuous because, frankly, there are institutions in Islam, in the Islamic world. All of the institutions, you know, one thing that has united all of the Muslims against them is ISIS. There's nothing that has united all the Muslims against them more than ISIS has.
But they still keep bringing up this fringe element.
Every Muslim
dirty tricks. Yeah, these are dirty tricks.
Every Muslim organization from India to Saudi Arabia to Egypt to Saudi to all of these, Mauritania, all of the centers of intellectual power in the Islamic world, which he's not even familiar with. I'm sure Sam Harris is not familiar with those places and those institutions. All of them have categorically condemned ISIS. All of them. So this, there is a consensus on this issue.
Yeah.
And yet he's using it as an example. So you're actually disregarding all of the institutional, what you would call fatwas, religious rulings and verdicts of everybody in the Muslim world. All of any scholar worth his, any scholar in the Muslim world has said the same thing.
Yeah.
So how can we ignore all of that and say, okay, well, this band of people... And Libya, the same thing, because obviously Libya and the thing have the same ideology. Libya, there's ISIS in Libya. So we're killing two birds with one stone with this, because frankly, the ISIS ideology is so far removed from mainstream Islam that absolutely everybody has condemned them.
Yeah.
I don't see how that has flown above his head.
They kill more Muslims.
Absolutely, yeah.
They actually have done more harm than to Muslims.
Yes.
Before we go to the next point, I mean, there was an FBI released some data talking about that the book that most of them were found carrying with them was showing how ignorant of Islam this group, the Insane State, is of Islam,
yeah.
A dummy's guide for understanding Islam.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. So this is really bizarre when you hear these things where people are just tuning in and they're wondering... We got our Redzovic Jiu-Jitsu. We're reaching out to our brother Joe Rogan, hopefully, so he can invite some scholars onto his show and give the Muslims perspective, have a fair and balanced approach to these very important topics because, once again, these things help fuel the division. They help feed into the hate, the misunderstanding, and that leads to the violence. We've seen a lot of it. We can discuss that more towards the end. Let's go to the next one. You ready?
Inshallah.
Called Bida.
Bida. Spell that.
B-I-D-A. I think it might have an H on it. I'm not sure. But I don't speak Arabic.
And the idea is that there are no... innovations. You should not have any innovation. No. Not the innovation that they already use, like Toyota trucks.
Yeah. For example, the King of Saud had a hell of a time. So Saudi Arabia was founded by the Ibn Saud family.
This is very interesting. I mean, you have Joe Rogan... who has a lot of knowledge in many different areas.
Yes, he does.
You know,
yeah.
He's one of the best fight commentators. If you want to talk about jiu-jitsu or mixed martial arts, he's an expert there.
Yeah.
And obviously, we're assuming that he wants to learn. So yeah. If you learn, you grow. But now when you have someone like this, he comes on, and he's just so, he's got an accent like you. He's from, right?
Yeah, that's right.
And you're laughing because you've dedicated your life to this deen, to this way of life, to studying Islam, to learning, to grow. How do you feel when you have someone, when you see someone like this coming off like, man, he's like, Mr. Sheikh, he's a scholar, like he's really educating Joe. Joe's coming to him for the knowledge.
Well, first of all, I wouldn't say I dedicated my life. Wallahi, if I was anything like that, I would wish to have done that.
Uh-huh.
Wallahi, that's first and foremost. But secondly, this guy, he's trying to use the word bid'ah.
Yeah.
And he didn't know how to pronounce it. He didn't know what it was. He didn't know how to spell it. He said he doesn't know the Arabic. And then he falsely he falsely gives a false definition, or he gives a false definition to Joe Rogan, who swallows it wholesale, and then he accepts it without questioning it, and then he kind of attacks Islam based on it. I would say this is not the way to educate yourself on any topic. It really isn't. What he was trying to say was bid'ah. And what he's trying to say here is that bid'ah is actually an innovation of any kind. So a technological innovation. And he's trying to imply that Muslims are averse to technological innovation. Of course, the hadith of Aisha radiallahu anha is of the Prophet Muhammad. He said, من أحدث في ديننا هذا ما ليس منه فهو رد. Whoever innovates in our religion what's not in it, then it is rejected.
So this is a way of like preserving the religion, yeah, right?
It's all religious stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It only relates to religious injunctions. So in other words, we cannot invent a new religious injunction or put into the religion of Islam what's not in it, because we believe Islam is perfect, it's complete. The Quran says in chapter 5, verse 3, الْيَوْمَ أَكْمَلْتُ لَكُمْ دِينَكُمْ وَأَتْمَمْتُ عَلَيْكُمْ نَعْمَتِي وَرَضِيتُ لَكُمْ الْإِسْلَامَ دِينَ. So I have perfected your religion, I have completed my favor upon you, and I've made Islam your religion. So it's not a matter of technological, and this is such a blunder. I mean, yeah, it's such a blunder that I can't believe that he's got someone like this on the show, educating him on a very important topic, and then he's swallowing it all up wholesale. It's actually quite embarrassing.
It is. So now if the person's making a major blunder here, imagine all the other mistakes, and you're swallowing them whole. And exactly, then not just that, it's different. You guys, it's dangerous. Okay, you guys having a conversation, then you go and spewing it, but you got a massive audience now.
Yeah, it's true.
And it just doesn't stop there. It continues on. He just continues on. We'd be here all day,
yeah,
you know, going through it.
We've seen so many blunders that, I mean, it's just one example of it. But it's such a blunder, to be honest with you. It's such a blunder.
Let's get through a couple more, and then we'll close it up, give some good advice. Hopefully, Joe Rogan, this will get to him, and he'll have a open mind to go through these things. And this is all in the essence of reaching out to him and his audience. So for genuine people who are sincere, who really want to know, they come into the mosque, because that's what we're dedicated. The Deen Show is dedicated to help clear up these misconceptions and deliver the truth to you about Islam, and bringing you experts who know Islam, live Islam, instead of some guy who's maybe reading a cereal box, getting some headlines, and he's coming out with a nice, the accent kind of pulls you in.
Yeah. In whatever team that we're on.
Right.
And when you're on a team that has, arguably in 2017, the most archaic mainstream ideology, that's Islam, right? I mean, if you stop and think about how ancient is it, how in its practices, the way, especially when it's used in radical ways, the way women are forced to dress, the way in Saudi Arabia, I think up until really recently, they weren't allowed to drive, right? Now they're allowed to.
Yeah, within the last 2 or 3 years. Yeah.
There's a lot of like stuff in it that we would think of as being a part of a bygone era of human beings.
Except for Alabama.
What do you guys say?
Well, first and foremost, I mean, he made the same genetic fallacy. As I said before, he repeats this argument quite often. It's an archaic religion. It's an ancient religion. This is called the genetic fallacy. It's a logical, informal fallacy, which means that you're looking at the origins of where something came from in order to show that it's false. That's not necessarily a way in which you can prove something is true or false. And moreover, he was actually inaccurate in his conceptualizing of Islam as the most archaic mainstream mainstream ideology. In fact, democracy, as I've mentioned before, the idea of demos and kratia, which are two Greek words meaning people power, originated much before the Prophet Muhammad's coming. So that's actually false from a historical perspective. It's false philosophically. It's false on every level. But then he went on to talk about women's dress, which I think you've covered it before, but we can kind of talk about it once again.
Mm-hmm.
And he said this more than once. Whenever he talks about, and I've noticed this, whenever he talks about Islam, he's got this two or three things that he talks about. It's the fact that it's an ancient religion, the fact that he says radical elements, not being specific at what is radical about it or what he thinks is radical, we're not giving evidence. And then he talks about women's dress. And he's been known and shown to be quite derogatory and offensive, frankly, with his insults of Muslim women's dress. The question is, on atheism, and I don't believe he's a person of religion anyways, on atheism, who he dictates what who should wear what? It's all a social construct at the end of the day, right? No one can prove that a woman can wear this or should wear that or should wear denim jeans or should wear tight jeggings or, you know what I'm saying, a miniskirt or whatever it may be. If you look at the sociological landscape in the Western world, there is this conception that the more a woman shows, the more she's in fact free and liberated. Well, this conception is actually very much commodifying and objectifying of women anyways. And you could say that the capitalistic enterprise in the Western world has forced women to actually, forced, pressured, and influenced women on every level to wear certain things which would be more economically, which would help the economy actually bolster itself. So in other words, one could make the argument that the fact that the woman has to take off clothes in order to actually fit into a sociological norm that has been constructed by certain people, probably men in the patriarchal society, that shows itself that women have been forced to take off their clothes. So if you have a problem with women being forced to put on or take off clothes, then once again, you should address the same issue as, frankly, even radical feminists address, which is the commodification of women, which leads to rape. Some say that this is actually a direct causation, not just a correlation. It leads to rape. It leads to different kinds of social ills. It leads to objectifying women, men seeing having entitlement. It leads to a range of different social problems. And he has not really said it. What he's doing is called an aesthetic value judgment. He's looking at something saying, I don't like the way that looks. Why? Because you're not used to it. You live in California or you live in Boston. I don't know where he lives. And he's used to seeing certain aesthetic things. Things look normal to him. Things look abnormal to him. You know, we had that. You can have a drink of coffee. You can have a drink of tea. You might not like coffee. You might not like. Who cares? It's your subjective opinion. Have you got anything to substantiate to us that women ought to wear this? Women ought to wear that? Or is it just the fact that you're a post-colonial white man living in the Western Hemisphere that thinks that women should wear denim, jeans and short skirts, and you're trying to enforce that on a different part of the world which has religious precepts which encourages women to be more modest? If it is the latter, then you have no case, my friend, I would say to him, right? Yeah. Really and truly, you have no case, my friend. However, your opinion is as valuable as it is for you. So it's subjective, it's your subjective opinion. You're entitled to have it, no problem. But I wouldn't go as far as to insult now women that are wearing something that you're not used to seeing.
And there's a ton of videos out there, and he can go to the Muslim woman himself and hear what they have to say. They feel liberated.
Absolutely.
They feel free now, right? Dressing in this modest way. There's a quote that really struck home, Norman Finkelstein.
Right,
I don't know if you've heard him. He quotes that people who came over to America at first, they had three layers of clothing.
Right.
Right. And then they saw the natives on the land. They were pretty much almost, you know, had nothing on. And they thought they were pretty much savage.
Right.
Then Dr. Norman Finkelstein, he says, now, how dare we?
Right.
How dare we insult, you know, the Muslim women, right? And now we're half naked and they're dressed. He's talking about the Muslim women. And we're saying that they're, you know, backwards. Something that's paraphrasing.
Absolutely. That's a really interesting thing.
That's from Dr. Norman Finkelstein. You've heard of him?
Yeah. He's very active.
He's a good person also for Dr. Joe Rogan to come on.
He would be brilliant. He's brilliant.
Yeah.
He's excellent. Especially on his anti-Zionist thing. He's got some.
If he wants an expert in this area, because he talks, he has some Zionist friends that come on. If he really
and
wants
he's Jewish.
To get,
he's Jewish as well.
And he's Jewish.
Yeah.
His family, they were from the Holocaust.
Yeah.
That is a fair and balanced approach. Someone who doesn't mainstream media scared to touch him, right? Joe Rogan, he's independent. Why don't you bring him on?
Yeah, absolutely. It'll be brilliant. Yeah. But I was going to say, what Joe Rogan's commentary boils down to is actually not only just an aesthetic value judgment, but actually a post-colonial narrative, which really is that the white man wants the rest of the world in his image. Like, when I say the white man, I'm not talking about the color of the skin. I'm talking about the post-colonial archetypal man who has seen that the Western experience is the pinnacle of human achievement. They want the rest of the world in their image. Moreover, what's interesting is, as I think I was mentioning to you before, they're actually, we've talked about nuns. We know nuns wear hijab in a sense. I mean, they wear the equivalent of a hijab. What's not known is that Haredi Jewish women, if you look in, just go online and check Haredi Jewish, like Orthodox Jewish women, they actually wear niqab, which is the face covering as well. Now,
these are now Orthodox Jewish people. Keep it fair and balanced. Why don't you talk about them?
There you have it.
Ask his Jewish friends to talk about them.
Absolutely. Why not?
Yeah.
Even if your argument, well, they're a significant minority. Well, frankly, the women who wear niqab, or the face covering in the Muslim community, are also a significant minority. Just the fact that you have 1.8 or whatever it is, according to Pew, billion Muslims and maybe about 30 to 50 million Jews might make it disproportionate in terms of numbers, but in terms of ratio, it might be the same. So if you have a problem with those practices, I don't see you making the same argument with Jews. You've had Jews on your show. Why don't you speak to? Why don't you bring this thing?
They usually make these arguments also about, you know, Sharia is infiltrating and taking over. They got no-go zones.
Yeah.
Talk about that. Don't they have places now that you actually have, you know, places where it's strictly for Orthodox Jews in your part of the world?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's absolutely right. Yeah, that's
now
right.
You've witnessed this.
Absolutely. I actually had a discussion in Speaker's Corner with one Orthodox Jew.
And these are peaceful discussions you're having.
Yeah, brilliant discussions. He wasn't offended. People can watch that. I
just want to talk to you about one issue that your experience. Forget about religion. Your experience. As Muslims, I'm always being told you need to integrate. As Muslims, we need to integrate. Integration. We hear this all the time.
All the time, bro.
Now listen, I was quite surprised and shocked. Wait a minute. Why? Let me tell you why. I went to Stamford Hill driving. And I'm sure you've done the same.
My friends say the same thing.
No, let me. I'm not saying it's bad. Listen to me carefully. Rovios, driving around, I saw an ambulance. Well, this ambulance is a bit different, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Wait a minute. Why is the ambulance so different? I realize it's a Jewish ambulance.
Yeah, they have the whole thing.
But then I go into the hospital. And there's a Jewish section.
Yes. The Royal Free.
Wait, hold on.
The whole top upstairs.
Hold on.
The Royal Free.
Yeah. The Royal Free. Wait, hold on. There's more to the Royal Free. No, it's good then.
The whole top section is theirs.
Now, I see the men in one side of the road and the women walking the other side of the road.
Correct. Yes.
Now, listen to this. The men, this is a street in London, yeah, in liberal London. The men are walking on one side of the road and the women are... Now, I'm saying, hold on. Okay, you've done what you needed to do. No problem, yeah? I haven't got a problem with that, okay? But we're not talking about inside the synagogue. We're talking about in the streets. Everything that Islamophobic people are angry about Islam with is found in Judaism. Done. Everything from A to Z. Wallahi, everything that Islamophobic people are angry about Islam in are in Judaism. That's something I'm making as a comment. Everything.
It's just me and...
And that's a lesson we want to take. We bring up Jewish people. We bring up other people. Yeah. We're not trying to offend people. We're not trying to divide people.
Absolutely not. But the point is, there's an area called Stoke Newington in London. This area is North London. This area is a Jewish kind of... I'm not going to say majority, but there's
what's it called?
Stoke Newington. Okay. Yeah. This area, North London, you have synagogues, Jewish synagogues. What I was really intrigued in finding is that there are actually ambulances, which are Jewish-only ambulances. Police forces, maybe not legitimately or, let's say, legally police, but pseudo-police forces, which are Jewish police forces. Not only that, you'll find that men and women are segregated in terms of on the roads of England, in the roads of London.
So this is Jewish Sharia police.
Yeah. In fact, there's actually a hospital called the Royal Free, I think it's the Royal Free Hospital in London.
Uh-huh.
Which there's a Jewish-only area.
Yeah.
So if I go into that area and I'm not Jew, it's like a kosher area or something, right? So if I go to that area and I'm not Jewish, they'll say, get out of here. You're not welcome in this section.
For real.
It's a Jewish-only area.
No, now,
we're
come
not,
on.
Yeah, honestly. We're not saying that, look, Jews are not allowed their own space. My opinion on this, my personal opinion is they should be allowed to do whatever they want to do. If they feel comfortable with that kind of things, we haven't got a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But be fair in your analysis, because when it comes to a liberal now trying to enforce David Cameron called the muscular liberalism, Joe Rogan should be thinking, okay, well, is this a Muslim specific? And this is something I want him to apply, criticality. I want him to ask the question, is this a Muslim specific phenomena? Or is this actually something which is cross-cultural, cross-religious? It applies to more than one religious or cultural group. And if you ask that question, you realize that actually, it does apply to more than one group, and Jews and Muslims, Orthodox Muslims and Orthodox Jews, are very similar in many ways. Most of his criticisms and things, would actually apply to Orthodox Jews as well.
Yeah. I think we got one more.
Okay.
And I think for the record, I hope that this, for people maybe joining us late, maybe tuning in, watching us on one of the satellite channels we're on, we're trying to... as you interpret, I think you did, if I'm not wrong, as this is a peaceful gesture.
Yeah, yeah, for sure, for sure.
Joe Rogan, who has one of the top podcasts in America, he's kind of stepped into a lane, and we're trying to help him, offering our services
yeah.
that we can help him. We want him to grow.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, we want him to talk with us,
yeah,
right,
yeah.
and learn. So we're making ourselves available, and hopefully he'll reach out. And how can people also help to get this maybe to him, right? This is where, you know, many of the Muslims and other people who are truth seekers who really want him to be fair and balanced, they can also help to...
Yeah, maybe put it on his... I don't know if he's got an Instagram. Put on his Instagram messages or comments, or put it in his comments in his next podcast coming up. Make it clear that they want to see... a discussion with a Muslim,
yeah.
basically. A fair-minded Muslim who's engaged in these kinds of discussions anyways.
Yeah, and if you got like, you know, tens of thousands of Muslims stepping up and say, come on, Joe, let's go.
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Let's go to the next one.
That they're willing to go to war. The wrong successor. It's a historical
That's it.
Difference between Shias and Sunnis, isn't it?
So it's like Baptists going after Catholics.
Now, you've talked about this topic in particular, excessively. You have some videos, and then you can also let us know where people can, if Joe himself or others, they want to see some of your work. Where they
yeah, so I've got a channel. It's just my name, Muhammad Hijab.
Yeah, like the hijab, H-I-J-A-B.
Yeah, yeah, like yeah. hijab. Yeah, that's right. So I've got a playlist on like my discussions with Shia. I'm a Sunni, obviously. I come from that background.
What does that mean when you say Sunni? So people know. What does that mean?
So a Sunni is an abbreviation of Ahlus Sunnati wal Jama'ah. Ahlus Sunnah wal Jama'ah means literally following the Sunnah of the Prophet and the Jama'ah of the Sahaba of the companions of the Prophet. So in other words, we follow the Prophet and the companions thereafter.
Prophet Muhammad.
Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and the companions thereafter. That's what the name is a derivative from. Shia literally means sect, or it could mean group, or it could mean faction. Right, yeah. So it's a sect which is an offshoot of the mainstream Sunni position. So we've had this kind of discussion with Shias. I've had maybe three formal debates with Shias, and many informal debates with Shias. It's on my channel. But the point is, this is really interesting, because what he's doing is he's reducing very complicated differences, and frankly, they are complicated differences, to... Oh, it's the success is different. Well, actually, there's a range of different issues. And what that does, it dumbs down the audience. Now, it dumbs down the situation for the audience. So people don't really know things. But what that indicates about this particular person is that they're not informed in that way, theologically, about differences between Shia and Sunnah. They're not informed about Islam in that way, which is required in order to make a commentary of Islam. So... I would, and once again, this is probably a good place to say, for Joe himself, if he really is serious about edifying himself and educating himself on this issue of Islam, because Islam is a big thing. It keeps coming up in his conversations. People,
That's the point now. Why is it, okay, now you're a martial arts commentator, you're talking about nutrition, martial arts.
Yeah.
Islam, just out of nowhere, Islam, a whole podcast dedicated on Islam.
Yeah,
it's not like it just came up in a conversation.
Why do you have to have an opinion on it? Yeah, you don't have to have an opinion on this.
So now you opened up a door
right.
for some constructive, some academic criticism. Yeah. What we did, we didn't insult him. We didn't go to, put him down or whatnot. But we're saying you're out of your lane. Come make it fair and balanced.
Make it fair and balanced. I think it's needed now. Because frankly, there is a reputation on the line also of his podcast. Because if he wants to have a reputable podcast, which features a variety of different opinions on academic topics, which is not highly biased, frankly, on this issue, there needs to be this, at least this this different kind of, you need to bring different people in.
Uh-huh.
And so we're saying bring the pro-Muslims in, people that are orthodox Muslims, believe in Islam, that can actually put forward a case for what we believe in and why we believe in it. And then you can make your decision.
Tell us, because you do, the facts are there. Anyone who goes looks into it, you have a lot of hate speech leading to hate crimes.
That's
you
right.
have a lot of mosques being not just vandalized, but mm-hmm. firebombed, you know, people being killed. In Britain, you had something recently, a few incidents, is this right?
That's right.
Man came and with the car and just, ran over.
Darren Osborne, that's right. His name is Darren Osborne.
And can you correlate this directly with people who are out there in this industry of fueling hate and division?
Darren Osborne himself, he was looking at a particular person called Tommy Robinson. Who was a vehement. He was someone who's an advocate for Tommy Robinson. He used to watch his videos on his iPad. He had a history that indicated that he used to watch this person. He's a right wing hate preacher, really. That's what he is, Islamophobe. And so that kind of, you could argue that through inference of the best explanation, he must have been radicalized by this kind of right wing commentary, and then he became someone who actually killed some people, Muslims.
We know the value of that. We cut off the internet. I mean, right now, people, as soon as you see them connected to some of these groups and someone says something online that seems like a threat, potential threat, you got, the authorities knocking on their door.
Exactly.
But now when these neo-Nazis, when, the KKK, when these type are spewing this venom that's out there,
that's
this
exactly
poisonous
right.
venom, mm-hmm. you don't see no one knocking on the door. That's a double standard.
That's a problem. That's a real problem. That's correct. Yeah.
Yeah. So what do you think now when people say, okay, well, this is freedom of speech. Well, there's no such thing as now, this hate speech. It's freedom of speech. You're trying to limit our speech, brother?
Well, what I would say to them is that this is actually something Joe Rogan mentions quite a lot, freedom of speech. There was a recent interview with someone called Jordan Peterson and Kathy Newman, Newman or something like this in Channel 4, where this topic of freedom of speech came up. The question is, what are the parameters of freedom of speech? Because freedom of speech is a precept which is an offshoot of liberalism. Liberalism is the idea. Liberalism, there are different kinds of liberalism. There's like economic liberalism. There is a social or fiscal liberalism. You can say there's, a political liberalism of checks and balances and what John Locke was talking about, Montesquieu and all these things. The truth is, on a social level, liberalism is, as J.S. Mill said, the ability to do whatever you want so long as so you don't harm anyone else. This is called the harm principle. Yeah, so you can do whatever you want so long as you don't harm anyone else. What is harm? Because if we're talking about philosophical liberalism, then when we talk about freedom of speech, we have to kind of tether freedom of speech. We have to refine this concept of freedom of speech. We have to qualify it with this harm principle. Otherwise, you'd have what you'd call utilitarianism, which is what Jeremy Bentham believed in, which is the greatest amount of good for the greatest number of people, which is what J.S. Mill refined. So the point is, this idea of liberalism is actually refined by J.S. Mill with this harm principle. What is harm? One could argue that, for example, using the N-word is harm. It's harmful. That's why we don't do it. Even if some comedian felt it funny to use the N-word, some white comedian felt it funny to use the N-word, most people in society would say, well, look at the historical timeline. Look what we've done to black people. And now you're trying to humiliate black people with something you know is going to aggravate them. So they're not going to accept the N-word. It's socially unacceptable. Really and truly, the parameters of freedom of speech are defined socially or socially constructed. What we're saying is that if there's a significant number of Muslim people that are offended with certain things, like for example, he keeps mentioning the drawing of cartoons. If they're offended by that, if they find that harmful, right? If you're saying that that doesn't matter, then I would argue that you're going against the harm principle. Because you're defining harm as the only harm that matters is the harm that I define that matters. So you wouldn't say the N-word. You wouldn't say certain things about Jewish people. You wouldn't make Holocaust jokes. Would Joe Rogan ever make Holocaust jokes? No. Even he's a comedian. He was a stand-up comedian. Would he ever dare make Holocaust jokes? No, because he knows it's going to offend a segment.
Challenge him.
Yeah.
If he's really about freedom of speech.
If you believe in absolute freedom of speech, and Reza, this other guy that he had on the show, he also said he believes in freedom of absolute freedom of speech. I challenge you to make a few jokes about the Holocaust, a few jokes about the N-word, a few jokes about other communities. Homosexuals. Make a few jokes about homosexuals. Say something about homosexuals. So you know you're not going to do that because actually society has defined for you what is appropriate freedom of speech and what is inappropriate freedom of speech. So why are you so upset with the left-wing people that are being socially consistent and philosophically consistent that don't necessarily want to harm Muslim people? And this links to another precept which is really interesting called the tyranny of the majority. Now, in democracies, one of the things that most democratic commentators said was a problem was what is referred to as a tyranny of the majority. When you have a majority of people that believe in one thing and a minority of people that believe in something else, And those majority of people actually exploit somehow or take advantage of the minority of people. And that could take different forms. And in our discussion today, we could say actually it does take the form of insulting or saying something which would be insulting to a segment of people, which in this case would be Muslims. What media streams have to understand, if they want to be democratically consistent, is that actually what they should be doing is amplifying the voices of the minority in order to create an equilibrium. If what they're doing is counter to that and actually amplifying the voice of some segment of the majority, which is actually antithetical to the minority, that does anything but exacerbate the situation and create a higher exploitation for the minority, which is anti-democratic, if you think about it philosophically. So Joe Rogan, frankly, in his commentaries and with the people that he's brought on the bandwagon, frankly, with panelists, has been nothing but fueling a tyranny of the majority that I would claim is happening already in America and the West, and being, therefore, by extension, quite anti-democratic. Mm-hmm. If he wants to be consistent, and he wants to humanize human, he doesn't want to dehumanize human beings. He wants to allow human beings to celebrate the human dignity. Then what he should do is allow for the counterbalance, amplify the voices of the minority, even if you don't like it. Noam Chomsky says something really interesting. Noam Chomsky is a very famous liberal kind of thinker. I think he was one of the most quoted people in a certain time period. In certain publications and books, he said, you don't really believe in freedom of speech until you allow the people you despise the most to say what they want to say.
Bring us on, Joe.
That's it.
That's it. Bring us on, Joe. Yeah, go ahead, finish.
That's what I was going to say, right?
This is the longest, for the record. Now, this is the longest show that we've done. The Dean Show is going on over almost 11 years. Alhamdulillah, almost 600, I think, episodes.
That shows that I do talk quite a lot.
No, but this shows that our sincere and genuine love that we have for the people to really connect with us. You know, we didn't go on a bashing spree with Joe.
No.
You know, we try to connect to him in kindness, in a benign way. We made a record now in history. This is the longest show, right? Because we covered a lot. He had a lot of guests, a lot of different topics.
Right.
Too much, you know, to go over in just one day, let alone just one show. But I think you did a great job, alhamdulillah. Okay. Now let us spend, we're almost at the 2-hour mark.
Right.
Let's spend a few minutes, because what these people do in this industry, and it's a big money industry, almost over a quarter of $1 million, mm-hmm. right? People don't have jobs. They're looking to get a job. So they join the industry of bashing Islam, right? Because the limits, the boundaries haven't been set. Like, you know, you can't go ahead and criticize or say anything about what these groups that you said. Mm. But here you can. So until that's defined, people are just having a free-for-all. And they're making money. Sam Harris, big money. Mm. These people, if you look to the root, they're making money, man. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's a money industry, right? Mm. So now we're hoping that Joe Rogan, right, his sincerity, right, his humanism, the human side can come out. He can bring us on. He can bring on someone qualified to talk it, to keep it, to set the equilibrium, like you said.
Yeah.
But now what they can't attack, or you don't see him attack, is the main message of Islam. Let's spend a few minutes talking about the main message of Islam.
Yeah, I think this is really important. If Joe is watching, that you know the basics of Islam, right? The basics of Islam is that, as you've mentioned, and you articulated, mashallah, very concisely, unlike me, I talk for a long time. But it is basically submission to Allah. It's submission to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We believe Allah is a God that we believe is the only God worthy of worship. It's not a new God or moon God or whatever. It literally, Allah comes from the Arabic word al-ilah, which means the God. In other words, the only God worthy of worship. It's the same God that all of the prophets before, like Moses and Abraham and Jesus and all these prophets, came and believed in that God, and they preached to the people to believe in that God and worship in that God. And so all of the prophets, we believe, came with that. In chapter 7, verse 158 of the Quran, it says, "Qul ya ayyuhal lazi inni rasulullah ilaykum jami'an," that the prophet is told to us to say that, "O human beings, I am your messenger for all of humanity." For all of humanity. So the distinction between the prophet Muhammad and all of the other prophets that came before him is that he came for all of the human beings, whereas all of the other prophets came for their locality. As it says in the book of Matthew, do not go in the way of the Gentiles, for I was only sent to the lost sheep of Israel. Say that Jesus came for the lost sheep of Israel, Moses came for the Israelites, etc. The Prophet Muhammad came for all of the human beings in the world, and he came to spread this message of submission to the one God who created the universe, who's sustaining and maintaining the universe, and who set the test for human beings on this earth. And frankly, this test is to either believe in this God and to worship in this God wholeheartedly, or to think somehow that you came into existence from nothing, by nothing, and you're going nowhere. And we would say that the first thing that I've mentioned here is more rationalizable, is more spiritually invigorating, it appeals to human beings more psychologically and rationally, and therefore, from our perspective, it's the best thing to follow. So we are Muslims.
Speaking of that, I think it was in your part of the world, Oxford, mm-hmm. they did a study. I think they had like 52 some researchers from anthropology.
Yeah, that's right.
You know this study?
Yes, yes.
And they concluded that it's innate for the human being to believe.
That's a really good point. That's right. So the study was done in 2011.
You know about that? Yeah,
yeah. It's the Oxford Anthropological Society. Mm. It was it was a multidisciplinary study that spanned for many years. In fact, it included many different countries, and it summarized, and it's not just a study, there's many different studies which had the same result, that the belief in God is innate, is intrinsic, is psychologically predisposed. Human beings are predisposed to believing in God. Mm-hmm. And that's why you'll find for the majority of human civilization, human beings have believed in a God, whether it be Allah or any other God by any other name. Mm-hmm. But they, human beings have been historically monotheistic, polytheistic. Atheism, yes, it has existed from a very long time ago, but it's only become popular recently within demographic terms. So really and truly, we would say that believing in God, and the God that created you, the one who sustained you and is sustaining us, is an intrinsic, predisposed part of our psychological capacities, which we should, if we want success, refer back to. Mm-hmm. And that's why the Quran is called dhikr, by the way. It's called dhikr as a reminder. Mm-hmm. Because in chapter 7, verse 174, it says, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, when he took from, with أَخَذْنَا مِن بَنِي أَسْرَائِيلَ مِن ذُهُورِهِمْ ذُرِّيَّةً وَأَشْهَدَهُمْ عَلَىٰ أَنفُسِهِمْ أَلَسْتُ بِرَبِّهُمْ قَالُوا بَلَىٰ شَهِدْنَا. That when we got from the children of Adam, their souls, because we believe in the metaphysical soul, this soul was basically, we say in a nutshell, programmed to the submission of God. So, and this, by the way, in philosophical works, like René Descartes mentions this in the Meditations, in the book of philosophy called the Meditations. When a human being was born and the soul was put into that human being, he intrinsically is predisposed to the idea of a God. We believe that. Moreover, when now the Quran comes, the idea that one and the idea that one God, tawhid, the idea that one God exists and that he is the sustainer, maintainer, etc., and that you should follow him, comes about, then human being recollects, he remembers, and therefore he comes back to his original fitrah state, which is the idea that he is built, literally, created for the worship of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
We thank Joe Rogan for the peaceful gesture, wearing the surname, the shirt that people are seeing constantly here.
Yeah.
And that's why we've dedicated. We see that genuinely, I think there's some good in this man. Mm. And God willing, God Almighty, Allah works in ways, you know, and I think that hopefully he's got something planned for us. So maybe next time we're going to be sitting all three of us together with him. And what you said, and we'll finish off. I usually give people this homework. I think it's something rational. We quoted this study because he's like a man of science, and these are scientists. Mm. And they're coming forward and saying that it's innate, the belief in God. So I usually tell people, because what happens is man-made religions, they usually push people away from God, from the creator. Let's say the creator, because people see the flaws there. Mm-hmm. But I don't think anyone can disagree when we say, look, the reality, can we say the reality, mm-hmm. right, mm-hmm. that created all of this, mm-hmm. that Jesus didn't create this.
Exactly.
So we're not going to worship Jesus.
That's it.
Moses didn't create this. Muhammad didn't create this. But they all agreed. They were brothers in faith. And they said, worship the one who created all this.
Exactly.
So shouldn't we? Look, I leave for Joe and anybody watching. This is your homework. Ask the reality. No middleman. No secretary put you on hold. Dial direct up to the creator and say, guide me. If these brothers, if these people, if these Muslims, which Muslim is simply one who submits to the will of God, if they're onto something, the truth is there, because there's something really powerful, that pure monotheism that people love. They love that about Islam, that there is nobody that you have to go through. You're not worshiping a saint, an idol. I often say a stick, a stone, a man, a woman, you know, your ideas. But you worship the one who gave you life and will give you death. And you call upon that creator alone, alone, simple. Guide me. Guide me to what the truth is. Why am I here? What's my purpose? Everything has a purpose, I often say. But you don't have a purpose, Joe Rogan? Right? You're just going to turn to dust, go to sleep, and that's it? Bye-bye? Yeah. That doesn't make
it
sense.
It doesn't make sense. No, no, it doesn't.
That doesn't make sense, does it?
No, it doesn't.
So what else? Anything else you want to tell Joe?
That's perfect, man. If we can see him now, that would be brilliant.
Hopefully, God Almighty, Allah, and you know, can get this to him. And you, people, like you said, they can share this. They can go ahead and
comment on his videos, comment on his podcasts, on his Instagram. That's a good way of, he will know. Mention the Deen Show, mention Muhammad Hijab, mention Eddie from the Deen Show. Mention those things in the comments, and if there's enough of those comments, he'll see them. And if he sees them, and if you even put the link of this video on that on the comment, that would be even better.
Beautiful. Yeah, and he can look you up, Muhammad Hijab, and you can see some of your work and everything.
Inshallah.
There. Beautiful. Thank you, my brother. Thank you, Jazakallah. And thank you guys for tuning in. Take that advice, share it. If you care, share, and tune in here every week to the Deen Show. We'll see you next time. Until then, peace be with you. Assalamu alaikum.